On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. 150 years after his birth, the ghost of Sigmund Freud still haunts us, and for better or worse, still guides us. If you thought recently about a dream you had and wondered what it meant, if you made a link between a childhood fear and who you are today, if you ever laughed at Woody Allen's self-centered neuroses or cringed at Tony Soprano's troubled relationship with his mother, then you've fallen under the spell of Freud. Freud opened the hidden mysteries of the mind to human exploration, and while many of his theories have been debated and debunked, he remains among the most influential thinkers of the last century. Up next on Point, the meaning, the debate, and the legacy of Freud at 150. And to start off the hour, we're joined from New York by Jerry Adler. He's a senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He wrote the March 27th cover story, Freud in Our Midst. And Jerry Adler, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Now, let me ask a really general question, which sort of comes out of the piece you did in the Newsweek. And briefly, you know, where does Freud's legacy stand today? Where do you see his influence?
Well, it's in flux, of course, and it's been going up and down ever since he died in 1938. The low point probably was in the early 1990s. When he was under attack from feminists and really from both sides in the recovered memory debates of those years. It's on the upswing now, I would say, because we're past that, and because we really are confronting once again the kind of darkness of the human soul that for which Freud was such a such a guide, such a kind of figure.
Now, why now? Why do you say that we're confronting the darkness of the human soul now?
Well, because of events of the last 5 years. Ever since the kind of optimism that we had about remember the end of history, that also coincided with the low point of Freud's reputation, and all that really changed on September 11th, and we now recognize that that history may have some nasty surprises in store for us.
Jerry Adler, do we have a sense of how many Americans are actually in therapy and perhaps benefiting from the kind of psychoanalysis that can be traced back to Freud?
Well, when the poll that we did showed that about 20% of Americans have seen a therapist of some kind, although at any given time, or at least at the time we took the poll a few months ago, only 4% were actually in therapy at the time. And, of course, those are not all, very few of them are actually in classical psychoanalysis as Freud, the treatment that Freud invented.
Hmm. So how do those numbers compare to previous years? I mean, is this are we trending up? Are we trending down? What's your sense of that?
Well, I think, what's true is that there's a trend towards shorter forms of therapy, less intensive forms of therapy, and so at any given time, probably fewer people are going to be in it, and that's driven to no small extent by third party insurance. I mean, insurance companies are not willing to pay for four sessions a week of psychoanalysis that can last for 5 to 7 years.
So they may be more interested in prescribing mood altering drugs, the Prozacs, and that kind of thing, rather than signing people up for psychoanalysis.
That's absolutely true also.
Okay. Jerry Adler, thanks for joining us. I appreciate us kicking off the show with your point of view. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's
Thank
Jerry
you.
Adler,
Bye.
Senior editor of Newsweek magazine. He wrote the March 27th cover story, Freud in Our Midst. And joining me now from New York is Robert Michaels. He's university professor of psychiatry at Weill Medical College of Cornell University, where he served as chairman of the psychiatry department from 1974 to 1991 and as dean from 1991 to 1996. He's also a supervising psychoanalyst at the Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytical Training and Research, and he's a practicing psychoanalyst. And Dr. Michaels, thanks for joining us.
Good. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and we look forward to talking to you throughout the rest of the hour. And I also want to introduce, from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. And Jack, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Anthony. Hello, Dr. Michaels.
Good to have you both. Dr. Michaels, let me start with you, sort of similar question that I started off with Jerry Adler. Sigmund Freud, still haunting us a lifetime after he died in 1939. Why?
Well, haunting us, inspiring us, and in many ways providing the terms in which we discuss whether or not he's had an impact and what it is. He revolutionized our thinking about mental life during his work in the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, and provided the very terms that we think about it.
For example, terms
like conflict or unconscious or ego. Stem back to Freud's thinking and Freud's writing. So when we think about the mind, we're talking Freudian language.
And give a sense of, you know, how much of a revolution he waged back there at the end of the late 19th century and early 20th century. I mean, when his career was just beginning, what was the state of understanding of how the brain worked and our understanding of the unconscious?
Freud himself had a background in neurology and neuroscience, and was committed to biologic explanations of behavior. In the 19th century, the kinds of problems that we now think of as mental or neurotic were thought to be an example of some weakness in the person's heredity or some diathesis from his constitution, and very little attention was paid to what they meant or what they told us about someone. It was Freud that shifted our attention to diagnosing hereditary neuropathies, which explained hysteria or similar psychological problems, to calling attention to what was going on in the patient's mind, what they were thinking and feeling, and recognizing that their symptoms were disguised communications about their problems.
Hmm. I read as well that at that time, I mean, when we're talking about the late 19th century, mental disorders were often explained in terms of demonology and were left to the church to treat, for example.
Freud once said that what he discovered was what the demons really were, and it turned out to be not mysterious supernatural creatures, but rather hidden thoughts and feelings and fears and passions that were inside our minds rather than in the world around us.
Jack Beatty, when we think about Freud and his legacy and how he influences our life and the way we think about the world, we're not just talking about how we think about mental disorders, are we?
No, it's a large-scale explanation. You know, psychoanalysis is not just a therapy, but a theodicy, an explanation of what went wrong, really of the mind suffering. And the British poet Philip Larkin reduced what went wrong to four lines. They bleep you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. you know, there it is. In the Freudian family bout, you have in this corner the helpless infant, the clamorous child, the seething teenager, and in the other, these omnipotent beings whose love the child has got to have at any cost. And the cost is high, for the child has wishes he can't express without jeopardizing that love. These get buried and returned later when, in Freud's striking phrase, the patient suffers from reminiscence. The parents get buried, too. And they get interjected into the unconscious, and there and from there they punish us for having such terrible thoughts and never let up. And in the middle, Freud has what he calls the poor ego, who's got to struggle with the external world while also negotiating the battle between these forces within him. He throws up his hands at this, and he says, one is inclined to say that the intention that man should be happy is not included in the plan of creation.
Interesting. I read Dr. Michaels just recently about in an article with reference to Freud's 150th birthday that
this was in reference to how it pervades our popular culture, that without Freud, Woody Allen would have been just a schmuck, and Tony Soprano would have been just a thug without his famous sort of Freudian psychoanalysis sessions that he has there with Dr. Melfi. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, just how it pervades sort of our thinking about the world at all levels.
In one level, you're talking about the popularity of the symbolism of the Freudianly influenced psychoanalyst or psychotherapist. But that's a literary or cultural gimmick for calling our attention to the opportunity to talk about what's going on inside of people's heads, as well as the observable external behavior. So one of the things that Freud's taught us is how complex people are, and how to really know someone, you can't only know what they do or what they say, but you have to have some way of finding out about what they think and what they feel. Tony Soprano in his therapist's office is far more three-dimensional than he is when he's running his gang. Woody Allen in his therapist's office is a much more complex and interesting person than he is when he's screwing up on the set. And Freud gave us a method for helping us learn what's going on inside people's minds that explains the depths of roots of their behavior.
I want to bring in another voice from Washington, D.C., E. Fuller Torrey. He's a research psychiatrist and president of the Treatment Advocacy Center, which promotes more responsive treatments for mental illness. He's associate director for laboratory research at the Stanley Medical Research Institute, which supports research on schizophrenia and manic depressive illness. He's also author of The Freudian Fraud, The Malignant Effects of Freud's Theory on American Thought and Culture. And Professor Torrey, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Anthony.
I'd love to just start with that provocative title of your book, The Freudian Fraud, The Malignant Effect of Freud's Theory on American Thought and Culture. What is the fraud? What is the malignant effect?
Well, again, Freud is a product of his time, and his theory of human behavior was basically that early childhood experiences are the determining factors in personality characteristics and how you emerge as an adult. We now know, which he didn't know at that time, that this is nonsense, that genes determine about 50% of the variance in most personality characteristics in humans. And of the other 50%, early childhood experiences probably determine no more than 5 or 10%. So his theory of human behavior, focusing on early childhood experiences, especially the experiences within the family, we now know is relatively nonsense. In terms of the malignant effect on American thought and culture, he promoted a culture of narcissism, a feeling that one's happiness is the greatest good, and that things like social reform and improving the world and responsibility to others, somehow that's very secondary. And I think that's become part of American culture, as one writer called it, the culture of narcissism. Secondly, I think Freud's theory led us to denigrate human personal responsibility, that somehow everything that happens is somebody else's fault.
And it's someone else's fault because it can be traced to early childhood experience or something terrible that your parents did to you when you were younger, or some traumatic experience you had in your preschool or something like that. Is that the idea?
Yes, that's all of that. Mr. Beatty gave you a little poem. I'll give you one also. At three, I had a feeling of ambivalence toward my brothers, and so it follows naturally I poison all my lovers. But I am happy now I've learned the lesson this has taught, that everything I do that's wrong is someone else's fault. That's the concept of irresponsibility.
I see. Robert Michaels, do you chime in here? I'd love to know what you make of this this idea that this malignant effect of Freud's legacy on the way we behave and our sense of responsibility.
I disagree with the label and the tone of what Fuller's saying, but I think I agree with what I hear is his feelings. He's not talking about Freud. He's talking about a number of popular thinkers who have attributed their ideas to misreadings of Freud. I think he himself is misreading an important issue. In describing the importance of early childhood and later development, he's describing the American version of psychoanalysis. Freud himself emphasized the biologic determinants, the constitutional givens. To take a simple but important example, we now understand obsessive-compulsive symptoms as importantly the result of neurobiologic functional styles. So did Freud. It was the American analysts who switched to an emphasis on early toilet training and childhood rearing. I think Fuller's misreading Freud through their eyes and their lenses. Freud himself was a heavy biologic determinist, and in that sense, way ahead of his time, in closer agreement with contemporary neuroscience than most of psychiatry was for the intervening 80 or 90 years.
Professor Torrey, do you want to respond to that? And I want to give you a chance to respond to that. I also have a sort of follow-up question for you.
I certainly would. I have great respect for Dr. Michaels, and he's made major contributions to our profession. But I think he's talking about Freud in his earliest years. In his very earliest years, Freud, in fact, was a pretty good scientist. He did some useful work on cerebral palsy in the brain. But once he turned to psychoanalysis, he gave up science. He himself said in a 1900 letter, quote, "I am not really a man of science. I am a conquistador or adventurer." He discouraged others from doing scientific research on his psychoanalytic theories. And after about 1900, he was very interested in the occult, in thought transference and things like this. I think to characterize Freud as a scientist after 1900 is a major mistake.
But didn't he go where he could, given where science was then? In other words, we're talking about a time before brain scans, MRIs, DNA, science, you know, the science of DNA. So there were limits to what he could pursue scientifically. Isn't that true?
Well, that's true, but the work he did on cerebral palsy, he actually did on brain tissue. There were some things he could do, but he actually discouraged some of his followers from using the scientific method to verify some of his early theories. It was more like a revealed religion to him. And I think there's no question Dr. Michaels is right. The Americans further took Freud's theories away from their context on it. And it would be very useful if we could bring Freud back now and ask him to look at some MRIs and brain scans and see what he thought. But unfortunately, we can't.
Well, I wonder, Dr. Michaels, what Freud would do. What kind of a scientist would he be if he had access to the modern science of the brain that we now understand?
I think there's several things we can be pretty sure of. One is he would be a great fan of Fuller's writing and Fuller's thinking. There's no question that particularly when one approaches the major mental illnesses, diseases such as schizophrenia or bipolar disease, the advance in our knowledge and understanding and in our ability to treat and help patients comes from our studies of biologic psychiatry, of brain function, of pharmacology, and of brain imaging, rather than from our studies of the subjective experience and mental life of those people. However, at the same time, Freud didn't have the tools and perhaps the talent to go into that kind of endeavor. What he did was expand our ability to understand subjective experience, feelings, thoughts, the life of the mind. They remain the predominant paradigm for understanding the vast majority of patients, those who may not have schizophrenia or bipolar disease, but may suffer from symptoms or personality problems or patterns of life that are maladaptive. They're also vital in this understanding and helping seriously mentally ill patients with their experiences. As Dr. Torrey knows, one of the limiting problems in treating the seriously mentally ill is encouraging and facilitating their participation in the treatment. And that revolves far more around their relationship with the therapist than around the nature of the prescription or the brain imaging that can be done.
Dr. Torrey, is there sort of common ground between you and Dr. Michaels, at least on this sort of very basic issue, and that is Freud's contribution to sort of coming up with a language and giving folks a permission, essentially, to explore the sort of mysteries of the mind and subconscious? I mean, you might disagree about whether it constitutes real science or valid science, but isn't that something that we can all agree is a huge contribution on his part?
Oh, I think it is a contribution, and I agree with Dr. Michaels on that, Anthony. No question about that. He gave us a language. He helped us focus on the unconscious, on dreams, although there was a large literature on both of these areas before his time, but he popularized them, and I think that that is a contribution and a contribution to our thinking. I certainly agree with Dr. Michaels that he had little or no contribution to seriously mentally ill, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, etc. I think where Dr. Michaels and I might disagree, though, is that the form of psychotherapy that Freud promoted to utilize, to help us understand our feelings, thoughts, life of the mind, psychoanalysis really is quite passé now. It is not cost-effective, and there's really no evidence that it's any more effective than many of the short-term therapies that are more widely used now in the United States.
I was just going to throw it to you, to Jack.
Yeah, it's quite right to talk of Freud as a scientist. He wanted to be, but maybe those aren't the abiding terms. Mm. We don't talk about Shakespeare as a scientist. We don't talk about Dostoevsky as a scientist. Yet we recognize when we open their pages, this is truth, not scientific truth. And that, it seems to me, is the experience one has in reading, a great work like Civilization and Its Discontents, this picture of man's lot having to renounce his instinctual desires in order to live in civilization, and the chronic malaise this produces, the unhappiness in people, this tragic picture. It seems to me so true in the way that the Shakespeare picture or the Dostoevsky picture is true, that it transcends the temporal vesture of, was he a scientist? Can he be proved? You can't prove Dostoevsky, yet he's true.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Give us a call and tell us what you think about the legacy of Sigmund Freud. Let's take a call. Let's go to George, who's calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, George.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I've gone through Freudian therapy for a few years. Started out 2 days a week, moved up to 3 days a week, and just at the point when transference was occurring in the therapeutic relationship, the therapist basically dropped the ball and didn't seize the opportunity that was available there, and in fact refused to talk further about the nature of the relationship. In effect, then, I was re-traumatized, and I paid for it to a professional.
My goodness. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, George. Let me. You raise an interesting question, and that is the whole question of, does psychoanalysis work? Robert Michaels, respond if you would to George. I mean, how do we think
sure.
about this? I mean, does the legacy of psychoanalysis, is it a successful one?
Let me combine his question with some comments that Dr. Torrey made earlier.
Sure.
Relatively few people are in psychoanalysis, as a psychoanalyst would think about it. That's a treatment that goes on 4 or 5 times a week and may go on for 4 to 5 or 6 years even. Involves lying on a couch and free associating, and is usually restricted to a relatively healthy range of the spectrum of all the patients that psychiatrists see. A huge number of patients are in various psychotherapies, often briefer therapies, usually more focused on a specific symptom or a specific problem, and several of which have been demonstrated by very good hard science to be shown to be effective. In fact, for example, the most common illness seen by a psychiatrist today is depression. And for mild to moderate depression, our good psychotherapies are as effective as our most effective medications. That's really quite striking and often not widely known. Also not widely known is the most popular, empirically demonstrated effective psychotherapies are derived from psychoanalysis. Cognitive behavior therapy, interpersonal therapy, two of the most common and the most widely validated therapies in this country, were both developed by people who were explicitly basing them on Freud's thinking. One of them was an analyst, one a psychoanalytic candidate. So we're dealing with derivatives of psychoanalysis which have permeated American psychiatry. There may be 10,000 people in the United States that practice psychoanalysis, and therefore maybe 40 or 50,000 patients at most. But you mentioned before that 20% of the population has had psychotherapy at some point in their lives. The impact of Freud is far greater in the briefer therapies than in classical psychoanalysis.
And Professor Torrey, let me come to you in this question about psychotherapy and Freud's legacy. Effective still? I mean, how do you rate it?
Oh, there's no question that psychotherapy can be effective in terms of learning about yourself. I think that it was well described. The important ingredients of psychotherapy have much more to do with the personality characteristics of the therapist, which Carl Rogers and others have made famous a long time ago. And for something like mild and moderate depression, that's absolutely right, brief psychotherapies like cognitive behavioral therapy can be very important. I think the question is always how you allocate resources. And if you have to pay a therapist many hundred dollars for cognitive behavioral therapy, or you can pay a psychopharmacologist $50 to start a person on an antidepressant, which is more cost effective in terms of society?
Robert Michaels, E. Fuller Torrey was talking about the cost effectiveness of drugs versus psychoanalysis. I'd love to get your thinking on that. I mean, are they as really so interchangeable, or do we need to think about psychoanalysis, providing one service and drugs providing another?
Well, once again, I think psychoanalysis is not really competitive with drugs. They treat such totally different kinds of issues. I think some of the psychotherapies, the brief therapies, are directly competitive with drugs. We were talking about the example of mild to moderate depression, where the research studies seem to show that the treatments are approximately equally effective in a group of patients. There have been big NIMH-funded and monitored studies demonstrating that. I don't know where Fuller knows someone who'll start someone on medication for $50. That's below the rates in this part of the country, but multiply it by a couple and you'll get close to that. However, when you treat someone with medication, you don't just write a prescription and not see them again. As we know from many recent problems with medications, you have to monitor and follow patients that are receiving a medication. You have to see them over a period of time. When you do comparative cost studies of the brief therapies or of medication and compare it to the necessary duration of treatment and the likelihood that the gain will be sustained after the treatment has concluded, you find that there aren't significant cost differences.
Interesting. Well, listen, this is a good moment to bring in one more voice into this conversation from Providence, Rhode Island, Peter Kramer. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University. He's author of the best-selling book, Listening to Prozac, as well as Against Depression, and he's host of the public radio program, The Infinite Mind, and he's a practicing psychiatrist and is working on a biography of Sigmund Freud. And Peter Kramer, welcome.
Thank you.
Love to have you chime in anywhere you want. I know you've been listening in. What do you make of Freud's legacy? And I'd love to hear about this book that you're writing.
This has been a wonderful opportunity for me, sort of a journey to revisit Freud in detail. I began psychiatry, as probably Dr. Michaels and Dr. Fuller-Torrey did, in the era where Freud was the great hero. And certainly my ambition was to do what Freud did, to see patients part of the day and write part of the day and to do original science merely by listening to patients. And we were taught psychiatry through Freud so that early on in our course in pediatrics and child development, we would learn about castration anxiety and penis envy, ideas that are long since gone. And I think Freud has undergone an enormous transformation within medicine in evaluation. You could go through all of medical school and never hear anything about Freud nowadays. So I think I think I would start from the point by saying we're thinking about a figure whose place in our pantheon really has changed very greatly over, within a brief professional lifetime.
Well, you mentioned some of his theories that have been discredited and rejected. I mean, if he was wrong about so many issues and so many ideas, why is he still so current? Why are we talking about him right now?
I mean, I think that is sort of a mystery for a biographer. One interesting question is what would psychiatry look like? What would medicine look like if Freud had never lived, and probably it would not look much different than it looks today in this sense that the ideas current when Freud came on the scene very much were ideas of heredity mixed with trauma and stress giving rise to mental illnesses, ideas very similar to what we have today. The treatments that were current included narrative reviews with patients even before Freud. He had a a colleague in Vienna who preceded him by really 30 or 40 years, Moritz Benedict, who had this sort of treatment. What's interesting is that Freud really popularized a certain aspect of what was already current and then extrapolated or moved it very far in a certain direction. And I think what is odd in reviewing the material is how little of that original movement, how few of these particular ideas that he added really have survived.
Interesting. Stand by, Peter Kramer. So we want to get some, we've got a lot of callers backed up. We'd love to get in on this conversation. Let's go to Rebecca, who's calling from Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to make a comment about, not using psychotherapy while you're on psychotropic drugs for depression.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been my experience that the drugs are only part of the equation. I think that the talk therapy is very important. I have not been under psychoanalysis per se, but I've been in therapy for years now, and the approach has been very eclectic. I think a lot of therapists certainly use some of Freud's techniques, although not under the same names, which is one of the things that y'all have been talking about, how he permeates language. And I just wanted to ask them what they, do they really believe that drugs alone will do it?
Interesting. Let me throw that question first to Peter Kramer, since you just joined us. Respond to Rebecca's question about that balance of drugs and talking therapy.
The three of us would agree most on this question, which is that the current evidence is that the combination of medicine and psychotherapy is particularly good. It's been studied best with regard to minor depression or depression in general. And there even are theoretical reasons to think now that some of the medicines we use may put the brain in a state where it is particularly receptive to new learning. So it seems that, it is the case that a number of years ago people were afraid to mix medication and psychotherapy for fear that one would interfere with the other. But I think now there's a very standard view that they're well used together.
E. Fuller Torrey, you want to...
I don't think I'll disagree with that at all. The one thing I would pick up on for Rebecca is the issue of being in therapy for years, where therapy kind of becomes part of your lifestyle and your religion. I think Woody Allen has been in continuous psychoanalysis now for more than 33 years. Again, it's a question of resources. He has the ability to pay for it, clearly. I don't know whether Rebecca does or not. But there's an awful lot of people out there not receiving any kind of services at all. And I think the misallocation of resources that has come out of the psychoanalytic kind of thinking is one of its main drawbacks and real detriments.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. Let's go to Isaac, who's calling from Pocatello, Idaho. Hi, Isaac.
Hi.
Thanks for the call. What's up?
Well, I had a question originally for Dr. Michaels, and it deals with his labeling of Freud as a scientist or a neurobiologist in his early days. My question is would it not be more helpful to think of Freud's legacy as instituting more of a mysticism, because when he does talk about the body, when he does talk about the id, he seems to frame it in very, and I think you all used this language before, very religious terms, and maybe we're downplaying Freud's substance use in the creation of these religious images, but it seems to me that Freud's contribution to psychoanalysis and psychotherapy in general is an instantiation of a willingness to be mystical about the mind and a willingness to say that there is an other inside of us that we might not be able to know. And I wonder how that segues with neurobiology's current research and attempt to reduce the mind to merely the brain.
Isaac, it's a great question. Let me put it to Dr. Michaels. Dr. Michaels, what about that, Freud's contribution more as, characterized as mysticism as opposed to pure neurobiology?
I think it's a very interesting question. Fuller remarked on it earlier. Freud was an unequivocal real scientist before he was a psychoanalyst, but that's not really his contribution that we're remembering his birthday for. If he did work on neuroanatomy, he did work on cerebral palsy, he did work on aphasia, and if that's all that he had done, his name wouldn't be remembered today. His important contributions to our culture and to psychiatry were the things he did about the study of the subjective world of the mind in his patients. Those were, as Fuller has pointed out, not scientifically rigorous, tested, validated ideas, but rather they were speculations, inquiries, and the development of models and methods. That's the first stage in a science. It's not the final stage, and in some ways it's pre-scientific, but it's essential. His concepts have turned out to be very rich. They've also turned out, not infrequently, to be wrong. But you judge a thinker like that not on how often he was wrong, but on how valuable he was when he was right. I don't think of his ideas as mystical so much as conceptual models for understanding experience and seeing important links between different kinds of experience, between, for example, symptoms and fantasies. Those links, the word that the philosophers use for that kind of thinking is hermeneutic rather than scientific, and that term has been used for Freud.
That balance, Jack Beatty, you know, that balance between the mystical Freud or whatever word you want to use and the scientist Freud, this is something that I think is near and dear to you.
Yes, and especially that message, that note of his interpretation. I mean, he was Interpretation of Dreams was his first book, and that's what this science is, rather than, say, physics, which exists apart from the interpretation. But I want to return to something that Dr. Fuller said and just get his response to it. You know, you said that Freudianism, psychoanalysis, has weakened the sense of personal responsibility, atrophied that. And I see that. There's a lot to that. And yet I'm struck when I look at human beings, people I know, of their inordinate capacity to punish themselves, to hold themselves responsible for things they have no reason to, for lacerating themselves. And it seems to me Freud is the poet of that, not of personal, you know, irresponsibility, but of the opposite, of people torturing themselves with responsibility.
Interesting. Dr. Torrey, do you want to pick up on that? That's a provocative point that Jack raises.
Well, Jack's perfectly right. There's a subgroup of people who do torture themselves, and some of those certainly can benefit from some form of psychotherapy to try and understand why they do that. I think that's a separate issue from Freud's overall legacy, which I think is one promoting the fact that I'm really not responsible for things because my mother did this to me, or if my brother hadn't been born when I was at my critical stage, I wouldn't be the lousy person I am today. And I think that that's the main legacy of Freud.
If I may jump in.
Yeah, Peter Kramer, go ahead.
Jack Beatty, partway through what you were saying, I thought you were going to turn another corner, which is this sincerity and authenticity distinction that Lionel Trilling made. You know, if your woman and your boyfriend shows up late for a date and you get an excuse, you know, you say, well, but really, you're annoyed with me, or really, you're afraid to make commitment, whatever it is that we say in the modern world. And, you know, there is an area where Freud added to people's sense of responsibility that merely being sincere is not enough. You actually need to examine your motives and, you know, at some other level in order to meet our standard of what a good response is.
Jack, what do you make of that, the point that Peter makes there about him, the sense of increasing responsibility?
Sure, you can't take things at face value. I mean, psychoanalysis is a science of suspicion. What's behind what you say? Things aren't innocent. I quite agree with that.
And Dr. Michaels, the advance of mood-altering drugs like Prozac and the like, will these one day make a kind of Freudian-style talking therapy obsolete? Do you worry about that? Is that a possibility?
No, and no. It seems to me that the mood-altering drugs or other drugs we have and will continue to have are immense advantages and advances in our ability to help people, to return them to normal if they're abnormal, and maybe at some point, though we get nervous about this, to enhance them even from normal to better than normal. But they won't replace interest in what we think and what we feel and what inner thoughts are concealed from us that we might come to know ourselves better. I don't think I'd want to live in a world where instead of understanding my dreams or recognizing my inner feelings, I took a pill.
Okay, and I think we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you all for joining us. Robert Michaels, University Professor of Psychiatry at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
And E. Fuller Torrey, research psychiatrist and president of the Treatment Advocacy Center, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Peter Kramer, clinical professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University and author of the best-selling book Listening to Prozac. Peter Kramer, thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, last but not least, on our couch today, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Thank you for joining us, Jack.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help today from Matt Odette. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.